TFM.
Fun will now commence.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Journey, our dedicated Star Trek Voyager podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I brought us some snacks again. I hope you're excited. But this time, they might be a bit tastier than ration pack number 5. Here, have a glass of spinach juice with a touch of pear.
Chris, I think you forgot that I don't like spinach, but thank you for that. I guess I appreciate the thought.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know you don't like spinach per se, but I thought if I put it in a blender with some water and I made it a liquid and then I put some pear in it, you might like it.
No, I think you also forgot that I actually don't really like pear either. And so, it's very kind of you, but, maybe you could stop being so, thoughtful, and trying to kill me.
All right. I also need to update my, Apple Notes entry about, Matthew's culinary tastes. Yeah. It's a little bit outdated.
Yes,
I left the pear off. Yeah.
I'm very particular. I'm so sorry. I apologize. So
yeah. All right. Well, I'll keep that in mind for next time. For now, everyone, we're going to continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Voyager with episode 6 of season 1. This is Eye of the Needle. And here is a quick rundown. The discovery of a wormhole gives the Voyager crew hope that they might soon be home. But there's a catch. The wormhole is just 30 centimeters in diameter. Determined to make use of the anomaly, they figure out how to send a message in a bottle and hope for a response. The answer surprises them. Not only is it from the Alpha Quadrant, it's from a Romulan. Eventually, Janeway convinces the adversary to help them, but their hopes of being rescued are dashed by one more scientific twist. So, Matthew, let's just start with the science of this. Jeri Taylor, she wrote the teleplay for this, and she blinded me with science by taking a story that really does focus on the characters and just pouring on the science, pouring on the technobabble. How do you feel that that plays into the story? And I know you like to focus on the characters, but here, do you feel like the science is critical to making all of this work?
Well, you said that you'd been, blinded by the light, wrapped up like a deuce in the corner of the night. And I was just like, wow, simmer down, Chris.
I'll just say, if I ever find a deuce wrapped up somewhere, I am not unwrapping that.
Right? Exactly. You just don't want to be revved up like a deuce, another runner in the night. But yeah. Anyway, I love that.
Yeah, it's
that,
revved up, not wrapped
yeah,
up.
Yeah, that's yeah, right. Yeah.
That song has the strangest
misquoted,
lyrics.
To remind everybody how difficult it is to understand the lyrics of that song.
Yes.
I think it's interesting because, yes, there is a lot of science in this episode. But I think that they're actually really helped in this episode that it follows, of course, Deep Space Nine, where we've spent all this time with a stable, artificially created wormhole. We've also had the episode of TNG. I think is it The Price, where we're selling the wormhole, and so we have some experiences with this type of thing. And to me, I think what makes the science of this work is because it's an incredibly character-driven story about the experience of the possibility of maybe getting home, or at least being able to get a message home. Mm-hmm. And because of that, all the technobabble stuff just kind of works, right? It just kind of makes sense. You are able to, I think, be able to play along with and it more adds to the story than subtracts from it, because all of the issues then that they come up with because of the technobabble add to the consternation then that you feel that the characters are feeling, because you want them to be able to get a message home. You want them to have the possibility of possibly going home, which, you know, I mean, I think we're all in like that place where they're not going to get home yet.
Yeah, I was going to ask you at the beginning, actually, do you think they're going to get home in episode 6, Matthew?
I mean, no. which, you know, I think that is... like, I just don't, I don't know who thought that they could possibly be getting home, you know, at this point. But that's really neither here nor there. I think really the biggest question is not are they going to be getting home, but is there a way for Starfleet to know that they're out here? Because... that creates a lot of very interesting story ideas. And so, yeah, that's the stuff to me that's actually more interesting. And so I don't know. What did you feel about the science? Do you feel like it adds to the show? Do you feel like it subtracts from the show? How did you end up feeling about it?
Well, I think we're joking about are they going to get home? And a number of times early in the series, they tease us with this idea of maybe we found a way home. Maybe we're going to be able to get back. And of course, you know, they're not going to, because it's the whole premise of the show. So it wouldn't make any sense. Although, as we did talk about early on in our rewatch here, they do give themselves an out, like a possibility of finding a way home in case the audience reacts poorly to the concept of the show and them being so far away from all the usual wrappings of Star Trek. But I think what's important here, it's not that they might get home, but it's dangling the possibility of getting home in front of the crew then allows us to really explore how they're feeling about being stuck. And in this episode, you can see that it's starting to take its toll on them a little bit more. They've come to accept the fact that they're trapped on the other side of the galaxy and that it's not going to be easy to get home. And so now they're trying to figure out how to deal with that. They want to be able to let people back home at least know that they're okay. Certainly Harry does. I think the conversation between Harry and B'Elanna is important because Harry is, we do find out in this episode that Harry is 22 years old. And I don't know how old B'Elanna is supposed to be at this point, but I think she's clearly older than Harry. So it's sort of kind of like a big sister, little brother kind of dynamic going on.
Absolutely.
In their conversation. So I think this part is, I think the placement of this story as the sixth episode is really good because there's been enough time for things to settle down. You see it in the doctor as well, where he's had to assume the duties of chief medical officer. And also at Kes's prodding, which we can talk about a little later, Janeway is forced to realize that he actually is her chief medical officer now. He's not just a computer program that's going to help them. So things are settling in, and I think it's good. But I also, what I like about this story, I'm a sucker for this kind of story because I like things that deal with space-time and how the fabric of space-time works and how the wormhole could actually create this rift in time where the Romulan is from 20 years in the past. I think that kind of stuff's really interesting. I also think that Voyager as a ship is perfectly positioned for this kind of story because it was designed to be a small ship that goes on scientific missions. So it's equipped to figure out this puzzle. And again, the Galaxy class, I mean, Galaxy class has everything on it, so it can figure out the puzzle. But this is the kind of thing that I feel like the ship was designed for in the first place here. So I think it works well with the story. And then lastly, to the science part, I like the fact that we don't delve too deeply into the thoughts and the emotions of the crew. And instead, we're following them trying to unravel this scientific mystery. So it creates like a very straightforward thread for the story all the way through. And so in that sense, I think that even though there's a lot of science and there's a lot of techno babble in here, although the techno babble is not as, it's not as like crazy. It's just technical language. There's not as much that's just completely made up like we sometimes get, but I think it works.
Well, I think the most important part about the techno babble here is that a lot of it we've heard before, because it's the temporal mechanics we're used to in Star Trek by this point. Talk about a wormhole, we're saving time in a bottle. And I think the biggest thing that we then get a chance to learn here about the crew, you mentioned Harry Kim, and we learn how old he is, and we're getting to know this character. We kind of have a character that we is so green and is really just a big mama's boy, which is, I find really funny. So in a lot of ways, we have a character that we've never seen before in Star Trek. Mm-hmm. You know, the closest character you get to this is Wesley Crusher. And yet Wesley is this wunderkind that, you know, sometimes seems less than human until they remind you he is, you know, like in an episode like The Bonding, right? Where, he's this kid who's lost everything and everybody just expects him to be perfect. But Harry Kim is just a guy who has barely gotten out of the academy. And we won't see characters like this again until Enterprise, where literally nobody has done this before, and all of them are, you know, they're flying on the seat of their pants, right? It's like they're on the edge of their seat the entire time because none of this has been experienced before. In fact, I don't know if we'll ever have we don't have a character like Harry Kim again until they kind of create the Hoshi character, which I think is really
an
extrapolation off of the Harry Kim character. And so, but I appreciate, again, this is an episode where we're utilizing what's happening in the kind of like science arena to actually allow us to be able to get to know characters, specifically Harry. And then I think the Doctor, as we mentioned, we'll talk about him in a little bit. But, and then I think this episode then also allows us to get a peek into the emotional life of Captain Janeway and the toll this is taking on her, and the fact that she's responsible for all of these people. She's the reason they're here and not back in the Alpha Quadrant because of the choice that she made. And so therefore, she carries all of this on her shoulders. And so the thought then, I mean, you can see why she's so excited at the thought that they could possibly, you know, get home or at least get a message, right? It gives her that sense that there's some way to almost make right what's happened, you know? And, and I think there's this is one of those moments. I think Jeri Taylor having a big part of the writing of this episode, it shows because she helped create this show and she has a real insight to a character like Janeway specifically. And this is an episode where I think we get a big chance to see what they were talking about in the previous episode of like her getting to know her crew, then though, and her letting some of those walls down is actually the thing now that's also weighing on her. I think quite heavily with this being lost in the Delta Quadrant. I hate to give it away, but this is like Voyager season one at its peak, honestly.
And this episode is generally considered to be one of the, you know, two or three best episodes of the season. Talking about Jeri Taylor here, I guess it's a good time to recommend, if you're listening to this rewatch, if you've never read Mosaic or Pathways, which are the two novels that Jeri Taylor wrote, I would highly recommend reading those because they do shed a lot of light on Janeway in particular, yes, or the crew and all, in a way that really no other author could do, because Jerry Taylor had such a hand in creating this in the first place, mm-hmm, that it's almost like delving into, in the form of fiction, delving into the mind of the creator of the characters and the concept of the show. So,
yeah, no, I agree. In fact, we covered Mosaic early in the Literary Treks world, and I was actually talking to the guys over on Literary Treks the other day and mentioned the idea of pathways, and they said that would probably be something that they will try to cover here in the not too distant future, because it's a nice one-off. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk about size matters for a minute. It especially matters if you've got a big ship trying to go through a small wormhole, which is what's happening in this episode. I thought it was interesting, and I remember watching this when it first aired, because DS9 was going on at the same time, and as viewers, we had this idea of what a wormhole was in Star Trek, and I thought it was interesting here that they encounter a wormhole, but it's so different than the one that we're used to on DS9, and I thought that was an excellent move. Obviously, you don't want to have something like the Bajoran wormhole, where you should certainly be able to get through to the other side. But so for the story, you needed it to be this kind of very small, decaying wormhole like this. But it also added some nice variety to the science of Star Trek to really show us yet another type of wormhole anomaly that you might come across.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think the way that it's portrayed, the visual effects that they utilized, and the idea that, because as Star Trek does this conversation on wormholes, one of the things that we realize, and is even mentioned on Deep Space Nine, is that there is something incredibly special about the Bajoran wormhole and the fact that it's artificially created, right? And that's why it has this perfection of being able to allow ships to pass through it the way it does. Whereas most the naturally occurring wormholes that we've seen before don't work like this, right? I mean, even again, in thinking of the Next Generation, this is not what we get. And so this is probably the type of thing you would come across more often in the galaxy. And so that part made it feel much more realistic.
Even if you think about current scientific theory, we've never actually observed a real wormhole like this, but
I mean, other than Interstellar, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the water slide tunnel in Contact.
Exactly.
But no, theoretically, you know, wormholes are probably microscopic. I mean, they're like on the quantum level, right? So maybe some information could travel through, but it's not something that a person or a ship or anything like that's ever going to be going through. And so here, even 30 centimeters is massive compared to what we currently think natural wormholes probably are like.
Yeah, no, and what I like about this is then it makes the crew have to get super creative in its thought process. You know, I mean, even when we get to the point where, you know, you're beaming somebody through, like, and you think about that, okay, well, you're then transferring energy. And so what you need is just to be stable enough so that you can create that transfer of energy and, you know, all that stuff, I think, is well thought out. Again, when you think of the Star Trek science, all of that computes then with where we are in Star Trek and what we think is possible in Star Trek. And I love the way in which then it creates that, oh, well, we might just abandon Voyager altogether and screw that. We could get home this way, which you totally see why they would. And then, you know, you could just have the ship, set on auto-destruct.
Well, you'd have to, imagine if you... But then, okay, so that takes us back to Caretaker, though, and the whole idea of destroying the Caretaker array, or what you and I talked about in that discussion. You could put charges on it and set it to destroy the array right after you leave. But what if the charges failed and then it was left behind? So what if the self-destruct failed and you left this Starfleet asset on the other side of the galaxy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at least with the wormhole aspect, I think that if the probe was still there, it would, it's connected to Voyager, and so therefore the ship being destroyed means the probe would probably be inert and it wouldn't be broadcasting from the other side anymore because it was connected, you know. So I think you would have been able to have that, you know, you would have been able to fix that problem if you had wanted this problem to be able to go away. You could have made the rationalization story once. So in that, I don't think there's too much of an issue, but no, you make a great point in that. That's the thing about when you're making all of this up, you know, you do have to kind of decide, okay, how far is too far with the magic of technobabble? And that's an interesting thing here, because Voyager traditionally kind of becomes known for that. And again, we'll get there at some point, you know, as we move forward. But here, you know, the solution to the problem isn't some sort of weird technobabble, really. It's the fact that, well, this wormhole is in time and space. And so it's not even about the size of the wormhole anymore. It really just becomes about the fact of, okay, are we going to destroy something that doesn't even exist yet, which is a temporal prime directive? But they already know that that is something they can't do. And so it creates this real conundrum. And I think that's the more interesting thing, because everything's worked up to this point. And then we throw in this final wrench, and it is incredibly heart-wrenching.
And that wrench was very effective the first time you watch this, because you don't see it coming.
No, you don't.
Though when you go back and watch, there are a few hints along the way, which I think are very nicely placed, subtle hints, even like the Romulans saying, I'm not familiar with the starship design. Things like that are very well done. When you were talking about technobabble, for a second I saw, like a long time ago, on the movie screen, now in Technicolor, I was picturing, now in technobabble.
There you go. There you go.
So, well, talking about destroying the ship, if they had to leave it behind, that plays a really big part into another key aspect of the story, which is the evolution of the Doctor. And the idea that, and this comes towards the end of the story, but the idea that if they were able to transport the crew through the wormhole and they would have to leave the ship behind, the Doctor is integrated into the ship at this point, and so they can't take him with them. And so he would be left behind. And I thought about I thought about Lister in Red Dwarf or Zora in Discovery. It's really the Star Trek shorts part, you know, in between Discovery seasons, where Zora, where Discovery is abandoned in the future and the computer is sentient at that point. And what that would be like for somebody who's kind of left alone like that. And here, it's especially poignant to me because we're watching the Doctor evolve in these first 5-6 episodes here. And building up to that point in this story, there's been all this talk about how we need to help the Doctor and help him be comfortable, and he's taking on this bigger role. And then he's starting to see himself that way, and he's starting to see these possibilities for his future. And then there's this idea that he might just be abandoned and left. And then he's fearful that he might be left on when that happens, which is one reason I thought about Lister in Red Dwarf, where he's, you know, everyone's dead at that point. He's just kind of by himself on this ship.
Yeah. I mean, The thing that I really like here, and something that we were talking about on the other side of the quadrant, which was there's such a great natural storyline here for the Doctor, where the Doctor is starting to realize, because of his relationship with Kes, that he is the only doctor that this ship has.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore that makes him the chief medical officer. And it is then, because of that storyline, having to dawn on Janeway that that is the case. And therefore, that character needs to be treated with the same type of respect that you would give to a chief medical officer.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as we've seen in Star Trek, the chief medical officer on a starship is an incredibly important part of the crew. I mean, how many times in the original series that was Bones a part of a landing party? Same mm-hmm. kind of thing you see in TNG, you know, with Crusher going on away teams, you know, and so therefore that character needs to be integrated into the larger structure of command of that ship, and they have a certain amount of authority. And so there is really something kind of beautiful then about the Doctor then having this relationship with Kes, that as she is growing as a character, she is helping him progress as a character
mm-hmm.
and become more of a person. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. I will say, look, we don't like to go too much into the future of this show, but the idea that we throw out here that we want to give the Doctor a name and that we never give him a freaking name in this show is ridiculous.
I was going to say, this is the start of your favorite aspect of the Doctor's storyline, right?
It's so dumb. It really is, I would say, just an incredibly dumb thing.
I don't know. So. I think it's kind of fun, but I also think I'd have to go back and research this. I feel like they originally intended to settle on a name and then they never did. And then it just became this kind of running joke through the series that we're never going to give him a name.
I mean, it could have been exactly that. But I mean, regardless, you know, I think one of the things that just then makes this fun is again, I don't want to get too far into the future, but right now, the show is doing what you want it to do,
mm-hmm.
which is to slowly begin to let you on the inside of who these characters are. And we're doing that with Kes, but now we're doing it with this Doctor character, which, you know, we haven't even at this point gotten to the place in Deep Space Nine where holographic characters are incredibly important to the show in a way mm-hmm. where they are almost like real people.
Mm-hmm.
So the Voyager is having to kind of create that type of storyline in and of itself without having that as a basis. And mm-hmm. that's what's kind of fascinating. And I think, you know, that'll become, I think, one of those places where watching the progression of both shows then and where they kind of utilize that type of technology and that type of character will mm-hmm. become really interesting. But
mm-hmm.
the most important part about that is that for Voyager, the Doctor is essential.
Yeah, well, that's the key difference between, say, someone like Vic Fontaine on DS9 and the Doctor here. Like, they're both real people, and they're treated that way by the crew. The Doctor, not quite yet here, we're getting to it, but the difference is Vic is a friend for people, but the Doctor is essential for the ship continuing to function and the crew having any chance to make it home.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't have said better, you know, and I think that it's interesting to be here in these early seasons, and this early season and this first season of Voyager, where as we've been watching through the show, who who would you say that they are trying to kind of pinpoint as being a the most pivotal member of the crew in the sense of like the one that they get a, you know, because all the shows early kind of seem like they try and pinpoint, like TNG was like this, right? Deep Space Nine was like this, and now Voyager. But it's like mm-hmm. they have the character they think everybody's going to like and they mm-hmm. write towards. So as we're at this point in the first season, who do you think that is at this point?
That's a good question. And I started to say Kes, actually. But no, I think probably a character that they didn't intend initially to be so important, but becomes important in the early part of the series here probably is the Doctor. And I think a lot of it has to do with Robert Picardo's performance, because I don't see the storyline that's developing here. It's always hard when you say this because you get so used to a particular actor playing a character that it becomes difficult to imagine someone else playing that character. But this is a case where I do think that the performance of Robert Picardo woke up this character and made the character a central part of the story in a way that probably wasn't intended initially.
Yeah.
I think initially the idea revolved around what if we had a holographic character that had to be part of the crew, and how would the rest of the crew react to that character, which is what we see with the Lieutenant Baxter here, who comes in, who can't seem to exercise without injuring himself. But because of the way Robert Picardo plays the character, it gets flipped around to what's going on in the mind of the hologram, and how is this character, who's not actually a flesh and blood person, feeling? And then the side effect of that is that they're able to start developing Kes's character because of the dynamic between Kes and the Doctor. And then Kes, because she's growing very rapidly in these early episodes, is starting to have an important influence on the ship. Especially in this story, it's Kes who opens Janeway's eyes to the fact that the Doctor is critical to the ship and that she needs to think of him as more than a program. And Janeway mentions to Kes that we're thinking about reprogramming him. But then later down in the sickbay, when the Doctor asks Janeway, "Are you thinking about reprogramming me?" And she says, "No." And the way Kate Mulgrew delivers that line is just so perfect and natural. And you can like see what's going on inside her head and how her view has shifted. And now she's seeing the Doctor as yet another person who she's responsible for.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think when I think about it, the characters that the show seems to be keying in on are Janeway, Harry, Tom, the Doctor, and Kes.
Mm-hmm.
And the strange thing about that is it does almost seem like it's really Kes who's bringing the Doctor to life.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
But it's their interaction. So it's those two characters, it's mm-hmm. those two actors together, which mm-hmm. which have a chemistry, I think, mm-hmm. which is allowing them to want to write more stories just organically. Mm-hmm. At this point, though, I think we have to also realize that these scripts were probably written months and months and months before these episodes even start getting shooting.
Oh, yeah. Especially and these early episodes, I think, when they're
exactly
like breaking the beginning of the series.
So what ends up happening then, I think, is you probably don't get as much of that thought process during season one, but you'll get it during season two.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're just hoping it works. So, you know, mm-hmm. you've had the Harry and Tom mm-hmm. storyline, and then you get, you know, the Kes and the Doctor storyline, which they seem to be very set on those as being relationships they want to work in the show. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think in that point, the writers just get lucky that they actually work. And like yeah. you said, a big part of that becomes it's Kes, but Bob Picardo's portrayal of the Doctor makes him a star.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like Data, right? Yeah. You know, I mean, he becomes the Data of the show in that sense.
Mm, yeah, that's a good comparison as well. Yeah, I mean, to that point, so they're writing this storyline for the Doctor. Certainly, they're conceiving this storyline for the Doctor before witnessing how Robert Picardo is going to play the character. I don't know where the Doctor could have gone if it was a different actor and the story didn't land, like the delivery didn't land the way that it does. You know, maybe they go another direction with the Doctor as the series goes on instead of him becoming so important. One last big point to talk about here as we start to wrap up is the message in a bottle itself. The storyline focuses, as we've discussed, on the science and the puzzle of the wormhole and how to communicate with the Romulan, how they might be able to transport something through. At one point, it's agreed that the crew, because they can't physically go through, so they can write messages that the Romulan will take back with him, and then 20 years later, he will send those messages. And at one point, they were considering having us actually see the crew members compose their messages, which would have, of course, opened the curtains to what's going on in their minds a lot more. But they decided not to do that. So instead, we just know that they're composing messages, but we stay focused on figuring out the scientific puzzle. So how did you feel that decision worked for the story? Would you have wanted to see more of them actually writing the messages and kind of sharing a lot more of their inner thoughts more clearly?
I think that that works better maybe in a longer form storytelling, like, you know, in a film, mm-hmm. you know, but I don't think that works here. And partly because I think we're actually getting all of that by the characters dialoguing while they're working mm-hmm. rather than just actually them mm-hmm. writing the letters, you know.
And also I think, just their facial expressions and just their yes. reactions.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. you know, it's all over Harry Kim's face, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's that moment after Janeway finishes talking to Telek Ramore, right? And she's in her quarters and she just has that moment where she kind of looks out the window of her quarters and she's very pensive and thinking deeply. And again, it's a perfect moment of allowing us to see the way in which the decisions that she's made so far are weighing on her. And she has written all over her face. She knows exactly what this would mean to her crew to be able to have letters get home, mm-hmm. which I would say is probably the one downside to this issue, this episode. I don't think that they should have let us know that he died. Mm-hmm. I think they should have left the question open because you can frame the episode more of like, okay, we're giving him these letters. It's 20 years in the past. We have no idea if he's actually going to be able to ever transmit them. And mm-hmm. so then you get to play with where each character lands on the hope scale. And that lets mm-hmm. you know who the characters are, and you can kind of play that out maybe in different storylines in the future. I also think that on Deep Space Nine, where the writers were so good at just laying threads that they could then pull on later if they wanted to, mm-hmm. it gives you the opportunity to play with that thread if you want to. Mm-hmm. I think Voyager hit an easy button here that it didn't need to hit because it leaves you bittersweet then at the end of the episode, mm-hmm. which is more what I want to be, whereas I'm just kind of left with like, okay, well, we just did this whole story now and it doesn't really mean anything. Like, I just mm-hmm. had an episode where, okay, yes, I got to learn things about the characters. That's great or whatever. But the actual whole storyline just leaves me in a place where it's like, but why then did we really do the storyline if there isn't some sort of like bittersweet hope and question left at the end. To me, that's how I felt, where I this was one of those places where I think Voyager leaned too quickly into the TNG mode of storytelling instead of picking up some. And again, this is still a very TNG type of story in that sense. But the one thing it should have picked up from Deep Space Nine, I believe, is the ambiguity at the end, which just leaves more storytelling possibilities open for the future. And as our Vulcan friend is always saying, there are always possibilities unless you hit the easy button.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. It's so like the original concept of this story came from Hilary Bader, who was an intern on The Next Generation. And then you've got Jerry Taylor, who was so heavily involved in The Next Generation. So shifting into that TNG storytelling mode at the end makes sense that that's what would happen. I think that's sort of how they think in terms of storytelling. Whereas if it had been the DS9 writer's room, I think they would have done what you suggest, which is just leave it open-ended. We don't know what happened. As a viewer, I don't know. I don't know for sure how I feel about it. I think it's a situation where, like with DS9, when you dangle a thread like that, it's easy to come back to it because you're going to be coming back to it in the same environment. In this case, they could always come up with a way to come back to it, but it would be tricky because they're out of touch with the Alpha Quadrant. And so perhaps for the viewers, you want to just give some closure to the story and let the viewers know that, hey, you know, this one didn't work. For the characters, it would, of course, have been a lot more natural for them to just wonder if their messages had ever gotten sent. And there's also the possibility that, because they've only been lost here, it's not that long, right?
Right.
Well, if he doesn't time sending the messages just right, maybe their loved ones get the messages before they get lost. Even a day before they get lost. You know, there's all kinds of things that could happen. So yeah, I don't know for sure at the moment how I feel about whether they should have closed that door or left it open. But I get your point for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just one of those places where, you know, we've talked about in our rewatch of Deep Space Nine, and now that we're in season two of that as we're recording this, that show seemed to be, from the beginning, working very diligently to differentiate itself from TNG because it needed some differentiation. Whereas this show almost seems to be, and it is intentionally, trying to basically be TNG.
Yeah, they're trying to recapture the magic of TNG.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or at least what they thought was the magic. I think that's the difference, right? You know, and that's a conundrum we'll talk about later. But if you ask me,
I think it was the magic of TNG. It's just that what is the magic for any given show is going to be different, right? So you cannot necessarily take that and transfer it over to another show and have the same results.
Right. No, I agree. And I think that might be something that, look, I think that's probably their issue here is they're trying to recapture something that exists on one show, but these shows aren't one for one, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, I think there's something really interesting about that. And I will posit here, this might be maybe, and we'll see how this plays out as we continue on into the series. I think this might be the first like chink in that armor, in that sense of where it's like, oh, we missed an opportunity that was really there. And so I'm going to be then looking to as we move forward, okay, where are the places where that might continue to happen? So on a whole, though, Chris, this is so far, it's my favorite episode of season one, and this is absolutely an episode where a Voyager, there are those episodes where where I could put on that episode at any point and watch. This is one of them. It's fantastic, I think. Even with my criticism, and I'm gonna give this 5 out of 5 pink nightgowns.
All right, yeah, I had a feeling you were gonna slip into those nightgowns before this discussion was over. okay, so those sound like your final thoughts, of course, and your rating. Yeah, for me, you can tell I really like this episode. One criticism that I've always had of this episode, though, and it isn't really about the story itself, but it's about the idea that we've thrown the ship over to the other side of the galaxy. We want to recapture the magic of the Next Generation being a crew on a starship again, but we also want to free ourselves of the constraints of the crowded Alpha Quadrant, Beta Quadrant. And yet, in the 6th episode, we have a Romulan. So,
yeah.
For the it's almost like they're not quite secure yet in depriving the viewers of familiar things. So we're going to pull a Romulan into this story. It used to bother me more. I do remember that when it first aired, I wasn't like, oh, cool, a Romulan. I was like, they can't let go. They've got to pull a Romulan in. But over time, when I just really dig into the story and I really think about how it impacts the characters, it doesn't bother me. It's fine. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting that they went to that well so quickly after separating themselves from it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's really interesting. And I think that's a valid criticism. I can understand why somebody would bring it up. I hadn't thought of that back at that point. And so for me, I think as I'm looking at the show now, I'm seeing this as that the Romulan makes the most sense because it's the hardest one to win over of the powers we know really from the Alpha Quadrant. I mean, you know, you give this to a Klingon, not going to be a problem. You give this to a Cardassian, probably not going to be a problem. You know, you think of all those, you know, the weirdest thing you could have done is given this to a Zenkathy, you know, which we'd never seen on screen. Mm-hmm. So that would have been interesting if you really wanted to rock the boat. But this makes it, you know, super easy for them to be able to do. And then it also creates that whole opportunity for Janeway to have to schmooze somebody into this. Mm-hmm. But I mean, she does. And I think that's another point to the episode, which is really in its favor. The way she does it is so natural of, you know, she sees an opposition and her first inclination is, let me get to know this person. So mm-hmm. I know then what are the right buttons to press that allow mm-hmm. us to be on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
Great leadership, honestly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that was something that was incredibly organic there to that storytelling. So, yeah, I think that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I also think it turns out to be a plus to the story and for
the character. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it makes sense here for it to be a Romulan, someone who is a clear adversary for Janeway as Starfleet captain, and yet she has to have this softer touch and try to get to know him. Yeah. So it makes sense. Other thing I wanted to point out for you before we wrap up is Telek Ramor himself. I'm sure you recognize who's playing the character.
Oh, yes. Mr. Vaughn Armstrong himself.
That's right. So as we go through Enterprise over on Warp 5, we get a lot of Vaughn Armstrong over there as Forrest. And this is the third character. So we all think of Jeffrey Combs as being everywhere in Star Trek, but Vaughn Armstrong is almost as everywhere in Star Trek. And he's played 12 characters, although he plays the mirror version of Forrest. So it's really 11 distinct characters. But this is only the third one, and he really takes off from there. And he's often under makeup, so you don't recognize his face as much, although I would say that I still recognize his face very easily, even through all this Romulan makeup.
Yeah, he's great. And I love to see him in here. So,
yeah. So anyway, great episode. I think that this is a very strong entry in the series, and I'm going to give this one 37 megajoules.
Oh, wonderful.
All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Eye of the Needle. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the easiest way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's a closed group there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. Of course, you can also send us email. Just go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose To the Journey. And that message will come to us right through the 30-centimeter wide wormhole by email. And you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not just waiting around because someone forgot to turn you off when they left the room, where can people find you?
Well, you could find me all over the place, Chris, on
social
media. You don't
know what to say to that one.
Yeah, I did. All over social media under the name MattRushing02. You can also find me here on the network in the 602 Club talking about all those franchises outside of Star Trek that we love, plus all the great Star Trek talk that we do on other shows, Chris. You can also find me on the Nerd Party Network with two shows. One's called Owl Post, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then John Mills and I love talking Star Wars on Aggressive Negotiations. Now, Chris, when you're not trying to figure out how you're going to time shift, you know, back in time so that you can contact yourself in the... Anyway, never mind. Where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm going to contact my 2-year-old self.
Exactly. There you go.
And then...
Hey,
and
how
then,
you doing?
That's right. And then little Harry will be there as well. When I'm not working on all of those complex calculations, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing all those shows with you. As you mentioned, you can also find me in the back catalog on lots of shows. Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time. And you can find me in social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Now, if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network, how to get involved, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your support. So thank you to everyone who is supporting us now. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time. When we discuss ex post facto, let's just be careful what we say around the dog.
I always am, Chris, but, you know, let's just, like, keep it mum and set course for home.